Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Navarro Wright.
Speaking.
Hi, this is Roy Paul. It's good to connect with you again.
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be joined with you, entrepreneur who was featured with CNN's anchor Soledad O'Brien for the fourth Black in America series, Silicon Valley, the New Promised Land. She featured a unique profile called The Accelerator in helping African-American entrepreneurs particularly get into starting their own businesses. Talk about your background first and then segue into how this concept came about.
Sure. I've been involved in technology professionally for about 20 years now. Had first 10 years of that career I was in the mainstream sector working for consulting companies. I was on a team that helped launch the first online pension application for Cigna Insurance. About the year 2000, I came to New York City and worked for a startup that was created by Russell Simmons called 360hiphop.com. Went in there and became the CTO. We were actually acquired by BET, and then I became the CTO of BET Interactive, which had just launched BET.com. So I shepherded BET.com for about 6 years and left there and went back and worked with Russell and co-founded a startup called GlobalGrind.com, which I became the president and co-founder. Was there for about 2009, and now I'm currently at Interactive One in the role of CTO in the process of relaunching a new version of Black Planet called Black Planet Next.
Yeah, I should also note that you participated in two panel discussions with the Gifts of Freedom, one in Philadelphia and one in the D.C. area. Talk about the concept for the New Me Accelerator program, which is actually on CNN as we speak.
Absolutely. So the New Me Accelerator program was the brainchild of Angela Benton and Wayne Sutton. Angela Benton is the founder of Black Web Media, which launched the site Black Web 2.0, which was the first site that covered African Americans in technology on the internet. And her idea basically was that there was a lack of African Americans going into the entrepreneurship field. There was a study about a year or so ago that showed that less than 1% of internet startups that were funded were created by an African American. So seeing that lack and that lag, she took it upon herself to partner with Wayne to create this program, which took 8 African-American entrepreneurs to Silicon Valley for 9 weeks. and kind of gave them a fast indoctrination to the startup world out there, connecting with various people at companies like Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, and giving them an understanding of what it takes to launch and create a successful startup in the Valley. So it was pretty groundbreaking because it was the first time someone had did this for African Americans.
Yeah, talk about the individual characters, their profiles, what they were interested in, and where they are now.
Sure. So, I mean, the people out of the eight were from various backgrounds. You had Anthony Frazier, who was from Newark, New Jersey. His startup is Played, which is a social network, mobile social check-in app for gamers. You had Wayne Sutton, who was from North Carolina, who was a serial entrepreneur, and his latest one was Vouch, which used Twitter to allow you to give referrals and recommendations. Angela Benton was in as an entrepreneur as well with the startup Get Cued, which was a social recommendation app. Tiffany Bell had a startup called Pencil UN, which allowed hairstylists and beauticians to take appointments from their clients via the mobile phone. And then there was Pius Uzumir, who he and his girlfriend Becky launched Decoupley, which was a social network for couples looking for dating ideas. There was Hodge Flemings from Detroit, Michigan, who launched GoKit, which was an online marketing and identification system for people to brand themselves. And then there was Hank Williams, who launched CloudCo, which was a service that allows you to bring all of your documents from the various cloud services and organize them. And then last there was Krishan, who launched FetchMob, which was kind of a community item gathering service that he was looking to launch on college campuses.
Yeah,
in terms of work, go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to ask you to describe how they were chosen. It sounds like a very eclectic group of people.
Yeah, so Angela and Wayne had an application process. People were able to submit their application online, give video pitches of their startups, and they waded through that list of people and picked the initial eight.
Where they are now in their startup enterprises?
You know, in various levels. Hank, shortly after the document aired, secured funding for CloudCo as well as Becoupley. Anthony launched his app in the App Store in late November of last year. Tiffany recently launched her app in the App Store in January of this year. Hodge and Wayne still have not received funding, nor Krishan, but they're still working on their products. And actually, Wayne and Angela are actually in Silicon Valley about to launch the next class, the new Me Accelerator, in about 2 weeks. So, given that it was his first class, there was pretty significant amount of success among the group. When you look at accelerators, the fact that not only that some were funded, but as well that, you know, some were able to actually launch products coming out of that process.
Yeah, how did you get connected with the program? Did you know Soledad O'Brien before this documentary series?
Actually, no. I knew Angela Benton for some time. She actually covered me on Black Web 2.0 when I was launching Global Grind, and we kept in contact. And actually, over the last 2 years, I've started writing about entrepreneurship on various publications, hers being one of them on Black Web 2.0, as well as the Huffington Post and News One, and on my own blog, NavarroWright.com. So when she started the idea, she reached out to me, and I became a mentor in the program and actually talked to her a lot about, as she was setting the program up, giving her advice as well. In terms of the CNN piece, no, I hadn't met Soledad until they started airing it. I was actually involved and agreed to be a mentor with Angela even before CNN got involved.
Yeah, I've heard your story before. I've heard you talk about the difficulties that you had in some of your companies in getting, you know, your entrepreneur status off the ground. Talk about your struggles and if you had any similarities with many of the eight people who are on the show.
I think, specifically in launching Global Grind, I mean, I was in a similar case out in the Valley, pitching my product, actually meeting with VCs. You know, I probably did about 65 VC pitches in the process of securing funding. Was fortunate enough to actually get funding from Excel Partners and Jim Breyer, who had just recently invested in Facebook about a couple months before that. In terms of the challenges, I mean, definitely. I mean, it was my first foray into the Valley. You know, I spent a lot of time kind of researching and investigating, but it was definitely my first time in that environment. And they were new to the environment as well. And they learned pretty quickly that preparation and execution is key. And I learned that in a valuable way too. You know, I met some really smart people in that environment, met some people who were really passionate about their products and who were able to be successful in that route from places like Facebook, Foursquare, Twitter. And it really helped me understand what it takes to become a successful entrepreneur. It's not easy, you know, and I would say it's not for everyone, but if you're really passionate about it and focused about it, learning the process is key. And I think they learned that as well. The other thing that really stuck with me was that there were so few African Americans. I think at the time, when I was running Global Grind, there were two of us. There was myself and there was Michael Siebel, who was the CEO of Justin TV at the time. And I remember going to kind of, you know, summits and sessions with a lot of startup CEOs and being the only African American in the room. So it kind of made me realize that there was a void there. And after that process ended for me, I kind of dedicated myself to really trying to educate and raise the awareness of the entrepreneurship opportunity to African Americans, because I just don't believe that enough of us understand how big the opportunity is or understand how to go about getting involved in the right way.
Yeah, and is the access to that information readily available? I mean, can people just go on the internet and find it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's definitely more available today than even when I went through the process. You know, there's leading VCs who are now writing blogs about entrepreneurs. I think, you know, Fred Wilson from Union Square Ventures has a blog which gives some great information. Mark Suster is another VC that I can think of who actually used to be an entrepreneur. So, yeah, really, if you take the time and the effort and the focus, there's a lot of information out there that kind of lets you know the groundwork, like lets you understand about, you know, how far along your product needs to be before you go for an investment, what type of investments you should be looking for, how you need to focus and think about your product to be successful. I mean, these are all really key things. I think for us, you know, as minorities, you know, what I try to do is fill the gap and kind of make people understand that, you know, the barrier to entry for internet entrepreneurship is actually lower than it's ever been. The tools are readily available. The ability to learn skills are readily available online, more so today than ever. And I think building an awareness about those opportunities will allow us to have more people, you know, try out entrepreneurship. And if you think about kind of where we are demographically and the unemployment rates, this is really the best time for people to kind of stick their toe in the water and become entrepreneurs.
Yeah, many people would say that the language of technology starts when you're young. You know, it's sort of like, you know, teach a child when they're young and they'll grow old and they won't depart from it. What was your access to technology when you were growing up?
You know, eons ago is when it was. That's what it feels like. But you know, I had a typical story. My family, I think, had a Commodore 64 was my first computer in the home years ago. But my first real exposure to technology was, you know, I was fortunate enough to go away to a school called the Solbury School in New Hope, Pennsylvania, which is a preparatory school, and I had a teacher there who introduced us to computers. You know, in a class, we were creating graphic art shows using Apple IIe's at the time, and it was really my first interest, and I fell in love with it there. But back in those days, you know, people always told you you had to be a lawyer or an accountant to be successful. So in listening to that, you know, I went to school as an accounting major, but really quickly realized that, you know, computers is where I wanted to be. And this was pre-internet, so, you know, there definitely was a lack of African Americans, just lack of people in general going down that path. But I kind of stayed with it. And after I graduated, things started becoming more visual, you know, and I started seeing where you'd have a program that had video in it and people were talking and training you. And I realized early on that technology was more of an enabler, now that it wasn't just words on a screen, it was pictures, it was video. And then when the internet started to become popular, it really became clear to me that this was the way to go. And I've continued to believe that. I mean, I've been able to go places and do things, and I credit that wholly for my understanding of the technology landscape and the opportunities in which it's presented me.
Yeah, try to connect New Hope with today's current public schools and charter schools. Many people would argue that the same level of access that you had even to the technology back then is not available to a lot of students now. There are public schools who the teachers are on websites trying to get, you know, different people to donate materials so that they can teach a class. And we're not talking about high-tech things, we're talking about paper, pens, you know, coloring books, nothing dramatic. So are young people today in our schools really prepared and making sure that students are engaged for the 21st century when it comes to technology?
Yeah, you know, I think we have two challenges. I think one is in a lot of those areas at the same time that the access to technology is very limited, right? And in most cases, the only computer they have access to is in school. And then if you also think about the lack of funding to train teachers to be technically literate themselves, because if they're not technically literate, they're less inclined to include technology in their classroom activities. So it's an add-on, right? And you know, I've often said that we have a perspective problem. The challenge is that we don't see, specifically our youth in inner city, don't see enough examples of people using technology, being comfortable with technology as a profession. So that never crosses their mind. To pursue that as a career or even look at that as a viable option, when on the flip side in the suburban areas, young kids at, you know, early age of 12 or 13 are building iPhone apps, making money from them, and it's second nature to them. So yeah, there's definitely a resource problem, but I think even more important than that is that technology can help fill the gap on those resources. You know, a lot of those schools, even if there's public libraries near, there's some level of computer access, but we're not pushing them in that direction. And I think that could bridge the gap a lot faster than trying to raise money for supplies, because a lot of the services are free online as long as you have an internet connection. To me, that's the big challenge, is that even if they're there in the schools, the kids don't see them as viable. You know, I partner with a company called Jubilee Children's Entertainment, that has a fantastic program called Dream Catchers, where they take people who are from the inner city who, you know, become fairly successful in their public and professional lives, and take them back to these schools and let them tell their story. Let the kids see that these are people who come from similar backgrounds and are able to, who have able to be successful and navigate. And for me, you know, it was extra special, because my first partnership with them was in Trenton, New Jersey, where I was from, and we actually went to a middle school that was down the street from the house where I grew up. So really trying to help the kids understand, you know, that their opportunities are closer than they think, and that they don't have to think that there's no way for them to achieve that level of success. I think that that's more important, right? The schools are lacking a lot of things, but the biggest thing they're lacking is the hope in the kids that they can do something different and better outside of athletics and entertainment, because quite frankly, it's actually harder to get in those fields than it is to get into entrepreneurship and other professional fields.
Yeah, you mentioned athletics and entertainment, and it always seems as though when it comes down to funding, school districts really focus more on the athletics instead of, you know, technology and other hardcore issues, when we know that, you know, it's not as easy to be, you know, Michael Jordan, certainly not nowadays, as it was, you know, as it is to sort of take the, you know, bull by the horns and create something yourself. So my question is, if Secretary Arne Duncan, United States Secretary of Education, said, Navarro Wright, give me some advice. If Jeffrey Canada from the Harlem Children's Zone said, I want to pick your brain about what we need to be doing to be innovative and leaders in the 21st century, what would you tell them?
I mean, I think for me, really what I would suggest to them is, let's give children access to technology at a very early age. Let's create a comfort level, because, you know, what I've seen is, when, you know, now there's so many resources available for children that if they're comfortable with technology, they can figure things out. You know, even my life, if there's something I can't figure out, it's a Google search away. And a lot of our inner city kids don't know that, don't have that connection, to have that discovery nature in them. So I'd say let's give them access to technology at an early age, get rid of that fear, and then put resources in front of them. And I think we'll see magical things happen. I think that's the big thing we're missing now in the inner city.
Yeah, to that point, when I was in Philadelphia, I remember you talking to one principal of the charter school, and you said you're going to pump all your resources into that school. Talk about that project and where you are, and tie it into this larger goal that you have of reaching a certain amount of people when it comes to technology.
Yeah, there's a program that launched recently called Code Year by a company called Code Academy, which is an internet startup that's come up with innovative tools to teach people how to code. And they've reached out through some relationships I had and said that they want to go into charter schools and put this to the test for inner city charter schools. And really the charter school only needs a computer and an internet connection, and the children can start taking these classes. But that's a classic case of the perception I'm talking about. They launched the Code Year site, and within 2 weeks, almost 300,000 people signed up. And if I dug through their data, I would have to believe that a very low percentage of that number are African-American and Hispanic, right? So what that concerns me is that at the end of this year, there's going to be more people who know how to code than there ever has been. And if we're not a significant piece of that puzzle, then we're going to be even further behind than we've ever been.
Yeah, so talk about what you're doing with that particular charter school. Have you started infiltrating the school yet?
No, so we haven't started yet. We're just in discussions, but the goal is to do a couple of things. Is to take people in who are willing to lend their time and support to give exposure to these children, to help them implement the Code Year program, and just provide them guidance on other resources that are available online that they may not know about that they can put as part of the daily curriculum.
Yeah, you mentioned race as a factor, and I want to talk about it because in the documentary there is one story or test where the one individual was walking home and was stopped by the police, and I think the reason was that he was an unfamiliar face in the neighborhood. When you have that level of atmosphere all over the country, it seems, and I mean it's not exclusive, but there are places where the color of your skin seems to be an issue no matter what degree of success that you've achieved in your life. Talk about the psyche of African Americans wanting to break through, you know, whether it's corporate America or the technology field, knowing that at the end of the day there are people who are just going to judge you by the color of your skin.
Well, I think, you know, bias and racism aren't going away. But what I've seen in my life, in my career, is that technology has become a great equalizer for me. You know, here's a couple of examples. One example is I've started companies out of my home and done business with people who we've never met in person. We've exchanged thousands of dollars and done business. And I can probably guarantee you that there were three or four situations that if we met in person, they probably wouldn't have done business with me. Right, because all they had to base on our business on was the quality of my work. So, you know, the internet allows you to transcend some of those racial bias. You know, I think some other careers that are more subjective in nature, you're right. You know, people can judge you based on your skills and your backgrounds. And I think even in the internet startup space, we're finding that challenge now in terms of people securing investment, is that a lot of times investors will say, well, you know what, I haven't had a lot of successful African-American entrepreneurs, so investing in you is a bigger risk. But we have to look past that, and we have to kind of put our products further. But I do believe having access to the internet and the skills to develop these products allow us to get further than if otherwise we didn't have it.
Yeah, are there a group of investors, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, are there a group of investors who are specifically targeting African-Americans or minorities in general who are seeking funding for different ventures like this, technology ventures?
No, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's minority investors. There's not a huge amount of, African-American VCs in the tech space. But to a certain degree, I don't necessarily believe, you know, that's necessary. I think what's necessary is for us to get more African-Americans and Hispanics into the ecosystem, for us to have some successes, and then it doesn't matter if they're only focusing on a certain ethnic group. It matters that they're focusing on successful products, right? The challenge with that is it's a limiter, and I think we can transcend that by getting us more involved in the ecosystem. I think the other thing is that there aren't a lot of, because there's not a lot of successful entrepreneurs, there aren't a lot of African-American VCs, right? Because usually most VCs were an entrepreneur at one point, were able to exit from their company, achieve some wealth, and now they're reinvesting in other companies, right? 500 mm-hmm. Startups is a great example. Y Combinator, Techstars, these are all run by people who are at one point were entrepreneurs themselves, you know, and the New Me Accelerator is a great example. You know, Angela was an entrepreneur herself. Wayne was an entrepreneur himself. So they created this program based on the need that they saw. So we need to have more people in the ecosystem, and that's when you're going to have more people to give investment.
Yeah, is CNN planning a follow-up series? Is there anything in this particular documentary when you watched it over after it was completed that either they cut out or certain things that you would have liked incorporated in, say, a follow-up if they were to do one?
Well, you know, I mean, they're covering a 9-week process in roughly 45 minutes of time. So there was obviously things that hit the cutting room floor. I do believe they did a good job of capturing the essence of the 9 weeks. I mean, there definitely was more dialogue. There definitely was more interaction between the founders and other people in the Valley, which I think all of that is valuable to someone understanding. I think the biggest thing they did was they were able to show people who look like us starting companies and going through that path so that someone who's at home watching this can see it and say, hey, you know what, I never thought of that I could start an internet company. It never crossed my mind because I've never seen anybody who looks like me do that. I use Facebook, but I never thought about creating a Facebook app, you know. And I think the goal is, and my goal is that as people watch this, they change that perception. And they believe that it's possible. You know, in terms of follow-up, you know, the CNN Black in America series usually covers one topic at a time, and then they move on to another topic. So I don't necessarily believe that there's follow-up. They have done a great job of re-airing it a significant amount of times. I think it's on right now, and it was actually on last night as well, and it's been on several times since it first aired in November. And then they've also partnered with me, and it allowed me to go out and do screenings, two of which you mentioned earlier, but I've probably done about 15 of those. I actually just did a screening in partnership with Soledad for the Deltas in D.C., so about 1,500 Deltas got to see the program, and we had a dialogue afterwards. And I think every time we do that, it just opens up more people's eyes to the issue, the opportunity, and the dialogue, and I think that's what's most important.
Yeah, can you talk about some history, any facts about historically African-Americans who have ventured into technology and have been successful?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not the historian, so I know there have been, let's be clear, there's been people in history who've been successful in technology. There's people who are successful right now. The one current stat I can tell you, for example, is that Google, there's the Black Googlers Network, which is 300-plus African-Americans who work at Google, who get together and support each other, et cetera. Now, I would say that that's, if you ask someone today if they thought there were 300-plus African-Americans working in Google, a lot of them in the engineering function, they probably would say no, right? So I think, you know, the case is not that there's never been African-Americans successful in technology. That's not the case. The challenge is that there's a disparity. And for the number of African-Americans who have been involved, it doesn't connect to the number of mainstream people who've been involved.
Yeah, well said. For people who did not get a chance to watch the documentary, and it is on now, and but you know, we may have some listeners who aren't familiar with the documentary, but may be interested in entrepreneurship or, you know, in starting a tech startup. What are some of the key points that they should be aware of?
Sorry, you faded out for a little bit. So I think the main key point is understanding the process and the environment that you want to go into. I'm going to pause you for 1 second because I think I'm hearing out feedback. Hold on 1 second. So, yeah, the one thing I would say in reiterating is that being involved in any industry is to understand that industry. You know, the analogy I always give to people that if I was going to start a beauty salon, you know, I better learn how to do hair, because if I don't know how to do hair, there's no reason for me to start a salon, or at least understand what it takes to do good hair. And I think what I've seen a lot of times, specifically in technology entrepreneurship, is because it's so prevalent, technology so around us, that people believe that they can go into the industry without that same background and knowledge.
Okay. Is there any other particular point in terms of your overall feeling about technology and the integration of how it all works with respect to startup companies?
Yeah, I mean, you know, no, because really I look at technology as a tool, like any other tool in the process. So, you know, again, it's really about understanding the tool. So if I'm going to be a technology entrepreneur, you know, I'm a big believer that you should know how to create and use the technology. The other thing I've found is a lot of people I talk to want to get in technology entrepreneurship, and they'll say, hey, if I can find someone to fund me building this, then I can get it started. But the challenge in that is finding someone technical to partner with you is really hard, even in mainstream society. Like, you read stories where Google will take engineers from Facebook and vice versa. So that's really hard. But the other challenge is, if you have to wait for someone else to build your idea, you're already falling behind. I mean, there's these things called hackathons where people will go in on Friday. They'll code based on other people's platforms and APIs, and they'll come out Monday with a prototype of their product, but they already have a product. So that helps them in fundraising. That helps them in kind of testing their idea. And if you can't do that, you're already at a disadvantage.
Talk about this no-whack demos concept.
Sure. So that really came about, you know, was part of, in the documentary, they show a dinner conversation that I had with the new me entrepreneurs right after their initial pitch session at Google. And in my opinion, none of them really did well. And if you've seen the documentary, you can see that they didn't come prepared, you know, and part of my conversation with them, you know, I really said, look, you got to understand the vastness of this opportunity. And just in general, if you're going to make the decision to do something, you should be prepared for that. So if I'm going to decide to be an entrepreneur and recognize that entrepreneurship is all about opportunity, I need to be prepared to take advantage of any opportunity, right? I could be walking down the street, bump into someone in a chance meeting, and they may, you know, have a conversation with them and tell them that I'm an entrepreneur. And they'll say, well, hey, let me hear about your company. And they'll be ready for me to pitch. Their articulation was that they didn't know that they were going to pitch. And my preparation, if you're a startup entrepreneur, you need to always be ready to pitch. And that's part of a larger process to me in terms of having the preparation to be successful, having a passion to be focused every day about what you want to do and being obsessed with it, and then having the ability to execute on that, right? And really what I said to those guys and summed it up is that you can't have a whack demo. Is that you have to be prepared, you have to be better, because we're in a space where we're being trendsetters. And if African-Americans, every time African-Americans groundbreak a new area, we have to be better than everyone else because everyone's looking for us to not be successful. So basically what I said to them in my concept, which I've kind of stuck with that, is you can't have a whack demo. You can't come out there and not be prepared. You can't not be focused. You can't not have your information there. You can't not be able to clearly articulate what your idea is and how you're going to execute on it. Because sometimes when we get opportunities, it's worse than not having them because we don't recognize how big the opportunity is and we don't take advantage of the moment. And my goal is to push people to never be in that situation, to not be able to walk away and say, you know what, that was whack. I didn't take advantage of that opportunity. And it's funny because the no whack tagline is kind of stuck. There's T-shirts now. So it's kind of stuck with people because when I said it, it kind of resonated to people, which is really about be focused, be prepared, be passionate, and be ready to execute.
Yeah, I saw you had T-shirts. You've become quite the marketing genius. Was this your idea to sort of take this campaign on the road and commercialize it?
Hey, man, I'm not just talking about entrepreneurship. I'm a member of the club. So anytime I see an opportunity, I'm going to take advantage of it. You know,
these shirts?
So people can get them at NavarroWright.com. There's a No Whack Demos T-shirt store that's live right now, and it's actually been pretty successful. People have been hitting me on Twitter saying that they've been buying the shirts and they've been wearing them proudly. And, you know, I appreciate it. I'm humbled by the support. And so it's gone well. It's gone great. I can't complain.
Yeah, I want to sort of segue back to something you said earlier on about you getting funding from Russell Simmons and sort of working in a partnership with him. How did that relationship with Russell Simmons work out?
in terms of how did I get connected with Russell?
Yeah, starting the Global Grind, and also explain that for those who don't know about it.
Sure. So like I said, back in 99, 2000, I first worked at a startup that Russell Simmons created called 360 Hip Hop. Two friends of mine from college, Mark Hines and Selwyn Hines, were starting this company with him, and they called me up and said, hey, we need somebody to come up in the technology piece. And I said, okay, I'd never been in New York before. It's my first job in New York. And I came with them and became the CTO. And that was how I first met Russell. So when we were acquired by BET, I was there for 6 years. And right about the time I was thinking about doing something different, Russell and I talked, and he was looking to get back into the internet space. And he had been talking to various companies about doing something. And I pitched him on this idea I had. And basically the idea was that, you know, during my 6 years at BET, we would constantly get emails and letters from different people saying, hey, there's a great site here that does Y. Why don't you cover them? And we weren't able to do that. We weren't able to cover everybody because we were a content site ourselves. So I came up with the idea of kind of creating a place that could be a central aggregation for sites that cater to the hip-hop demographic. And that's where Global Grind kind of came from. It was really about giving young content entrepreneurs a place where their content was first and foremost, because I believe that that was important. I believe that we have a voice, and having a technology platform that allowed us to do that was really important. So Russell believed in the idea, and we partnered, and he was the initial investor. We co-founded the company, created the first product, and I went out and raised money and then ran it for the next 2 years. So it was a great experience. Really, for me, in twofold, and working with Russell and kind of understanding how, you know, someone like that was able to be successful, but also getting my first indoctrination to the internet startup world and being in Silicon Valley and really understanding how that world operated and what it take to be successful. And it was actually exciting and engaging for me. You know, I always remember walking into some of those environments and kind of walking out with like a burst of adrenaline, because you just see such free-flowing of ideas going on in that space. But I remember leaving and understanding that I wish that more of us could see that and experience that. I think it creates a spark in people. So it was really a valuable experience for me.
Yeah, another piece in the documentary talked about the fact that African Americans, by and large, do not help other African Americans. Russell Simmons was great in helping you become a part of certain ventures, but a lot of people don't have that experience. What is it about the atmosphere within the African-American community that makes people say, I made mine the hard way, you have to make yours your way as well?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little deeper than that. I think the challenge we have is that, you know, we've had to work so hard for what we get, you know, and that's been throughout history. And there's kind of a misconception that there's only room for only so many of us to be successful. And you know, that's actually a big difference, really, there in how the Valley works. You know, I've seen people from different companies collaborate, give each other ideas, et cetera. We have this belief that if you're successful in an area and I'm in that same area, we both possibly can't be successful. So, it you know, I can't be supportive of you because I'm going to miss out my opportunity. And this is not the case. I think, you know, there's enough room for multiple people to be successful. And I think the more of us collaborate and make us more successful as a whole, it creates more opportunities for other people to come up and be successful. Because remember, I talked before about the perception problem, is that if we don't change it, if we don't create an ecosystem where I can go and easily see an African-American entrepreneur successful, what incentive is there for me to want to go down that path? So we're not creating legacy. You know, we're not creating a pipeline. You know, I one of the things I've always said is if I took a bunch of children from an inner city school, and I would always say Oakland because it was near Facebook, if I took a group of kids from Oakland to Facebook for the day, or to Google for the day, and said, hey, you know what, these guys, there's five catered chefs, they have all this free-flowing environment to be themselves. They can bring their dogs. They can, you know, when you walk through, you kind of feel like it's not really work. And then, you know, you said these kids would start asking questions like, well, what do I have to do to work here? I'm like, look, you got to learn technology. You got to learn how to code. You know, once you do that, you could probably get a job here. And we roll past the library. I firmly believe the library would be empty. And it would be empty because there would be a light at the end of the tunnel. They would say, if I did this, I could possibly do Y. And I think that's what's missing, right? And I think that's what's missing in a lot of situations for African Americans is that we don't get enough opportunity to see how big the opportunities are. So we limit each other by thinking that there's only room for one or two of us, when there's really room, if we work together, for a lot of us.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It was mentioned in the documentary that if you want to be successful in technology, you go to Silicon Valley. Do you really have to move to Silicon Valley? I mean, I've got some friends out in Brooklyn. Should they get up and move to Silicon Valley, or can they do it here in New York?
No, I think, Silicon Valley's definitely been the originator of the kind of internet startup phenomenon, but it's expanding. I think New York, if Silicon Valley's first, New York's definitely second. I mean, there's been a resurgence in the New York area of internet startups. You know, Foursquare's headquarters in New York City. Mayor Bloomberg is doing a lot for startups in the city. There's spaces now dedicated to startup and startup creation in the city. So, no, I definitely don't think you have to be there. I think what it does is in a small area allows you to kind of get fully immersed into what that environment is. I think it was great for the New Me program because when you want to intensify what that experience is, Silicon Valley is a great place for you to see it because it's established, it's there. You know, the New York scene is evolving, the scene in Boston is evolving. And really what it does is it gives you access, once that ecosystem there, it gives you access to resources to network and grow your company. I mean, you can start a company anywhere. There's a very successful company, 37 Signals, up to the south of Chicago. The beauty of the internet is, I can have global reach from my locale. The challenge is that, when there's not an ecosystem around it, you get a certain scaling point and it makes it hard to grow the company because there's access to engineering resources, et cetera. But I firmly believe that people can create that environment wherever they are if they're committed to not only building the product but also educating the community around them, and helping create those resources. I think we have unique opportunities too. I'd love to see startups come out of, the HBCUs in those cities and areas, and I think it's really just about educating people on the opportunity.
Good point. Speaking to education with respect to HBCUs and other places, I remember you talking about a goal that you had to reach. Was it 10,000 people?
10,000, exactly 10, right.
10,000
yep.
people. Tell me where you are with that goal and explain what that is.
Sure. So, really, God kind of put it in my head at the New Year's Eve, because the number kind of came from him is that if I can connect with 10,000 people, and educate them on the opportunities of technology, then the idea is that it will create an exponential effect. That if each one of those people talk to one other person, then there's another 10,000. If they happen to talk to five, it exponentially grows to factor five to where we could have millions of people being connected. And my important piece of that is that it's not even just about being an engineer. It's about understanding that technology can enable your growth in education, in healthcare, and in your business, right? So, I'm not even saying that everybody has to run out and learn how to code, but if you have a business, for example, understanding how technology can help you grow. So if I have a small business, knowing that Google has a program right now that they will host your website for free, that they have tools that you can use to promote your site across the internet through Google AdWords. There's a company called Square that lets you take credit cards using your Android or your iPhone. And most African-American businesses are cash only because getting a merchant account is really hard. So it's really about making people available and understanding to those opportunities to grow their business and reach really economic parity. That's the key because, unemployment for minorities is so high right now in comparison to the rest of the world. And really the only way we're going to change that is if we create opportunities to increase economic parity, which is access to opportunity and resources. And I believe that technology is the key area in which we can do that. So that's really where it came from. And in terms of the status, you know, like I told you, you know, I just did a talk in front of about 1,200 members of Delta Sigma Theta. So that was a great start right there. You know, hopefully, you know, whoever's listening to this one, this radio show, that's another jump right there. That we're well on our way. You know, we're well on our way, and I've kind of committed myself to traveling and speaking to groups and really having this dialogue. And it's picking up steam. You know, I'm having some conversations with some possible great partners to help me, you know, take the show on the road. So, you know, 10,000 might be the first phase. We might have to add a couple of zeros to that before we're done. And I think that'll be great.
Okay, it's my understanding that we have some callers on the line. I think caller number 87 or 77, one of you guys, are you there?
I don't know. I'm caller number. I don't know what number. I'm Joyce Johnson. I came in late.
Absolutely, Joyce Johnson. Your question.
I came in just 2 minutes ago, and I'm. My question is, who is the guest host? Because he mentioned Delta Sigma Theta just gave a presentation to 1,000 women, and that must have been Delta Days at the nation's capital.
That was absolutely right. It was Delta Days at the nation's capital. My name is Navarro Wright. I was partnered with Soledad O'Brien.
How are you? Great.
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I should have told you that I'm a member of Delta Sigma Theta. So I'm glad to hear that the 10,000, anything I can do to facilitate that, you need to come to New York. We've got 15 local chapters here.
I'm happy to do it.
Navarro, I should say, you know Joyce Johnson. She was on the panel in D.C.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
And she's running for Congress, and she called in to surprise everyone.
Yep.
I got from Ms. Giss, and it was sort of late, so I said, let me jump on. And I just talked to Paul, to Roy, about a half hour ago. So I'm enjoying this, and I quite agree with all that you've said, although I've heard, you know, on the tail end.
No,
okay.
I appreciate it. No, and your sisters were great hosts to me, so I was happy to be there.
And Joyce Johnson will help you connect with the Deltas here in New York. All right. Do we have any other callers?
And Ms. Johnson, you know, definitely you should reach out, especially if you're running for Congress. We got to get your internet situation together. We got to get your website. We got to get your Twitter going. Definitely reach out to me. I mean, your sister's been great to me. I got to make sure you get elected so we can keep this thing going.
I appreciate that. I will do just that. Offline. Thank you so much. I appreciate. I do need it.
My pleasure. Be happy to help. But we'll show people the difference that technology can make in a race.
And I believe that's true. Obama, it was his technology the first time in campaigns, but it's just like you said, I appreciated what you said. Technology now affects everybody. We seem to think sometimes it is so technical, but it's applications that can make anything that you do. I mean, just anything that you do. It's amazing. It's amazing. And I think it's my generation that sometimes we as African Americans, we hear technology. And I don't, you know, how the conversation went, but what's your sense? Are we embracing it at the lightning speed that others are?
No, you know, unfortunately, we're behind. And I believe, you know, one of the reasons why I'm really aggressive about getting in front of as many people as possible is that, you know, 2012 is a pivotal year. And it's a pivotal year because there's a shift. You know, there's programs coming out that are working to make more people technically literate, making more people have the ability to code, and I still believe that, you know, minorities, specifically African-American and Hispanics, are not taking advantage of those. So mm-hmm. What's going to happen is that at the end of 2012, we're going to have more people who have those technical skills and are employable, and we're going to have a large portion of our group that's going to be unemployable and going to be too far behind to catch up. So I really believe that this year is a pivotal year for us.
I'm glad to hear you say that because, you know, part of, obviously, with Deltas and so many other Greek organizations, our civics and all, economic empowerment is the word of the day. But I don't think we know how to really. I can't say we don't know how to, but I think conversations like yours, that you were smart to be in front of Delta Sigma Theta, helps us to define what that might honestly look like.
Absolutely, and I think the more people hear about it, the more people the light bulb goes off, and they say, "Hey, I know how I can take this and make an impact in my local area." And that's really all we need, is to create exposure and create awareness to the opportunities and to the issues at hand.
Okay, thank you.
I got to jump off, Navarro. It's a pleasure always. I always learn something from you, and we will be in touch.
I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Okay, take care now. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, it's my understanding that there's another caller there, last two digits of your number, 87. Are you there? Okay, I guess they're not there. Navarro, right, talk about your follow-up with some of the members of the panel that you were in D.C. I know Patricia Slooby had invited you to an event. Have you kept in touch with the other members of the panel with respect to different networking opportunities?
I have. Those events haven't happened yet, but we've definitely been in touch and in conversations from both the panels, from the D.C. panel and the Philadelphia panel. You know, I think Stephanie Humphrey's on the Philadelphia panel. She and I have communicated, and she's doing a lot in the Philadelphia area in terms of educating people around technology. And some of the conversations with people in the audience, you know, I think, you know, people are trying to figure out the best way to get connected and have more events. And like I said, I'm happy to do them and share this information and have great dialogue and conversation.
Yeah, now to what you're working on now, do you have any special projects, anything that you want to start working on coming up in the future?
Well, you know, my next personal project is a campaign I'm calling the Close the Divide campaign. And it's going to be a couple of factors. It's going to be a speaking tour. It's going to be a website under the URL closethedivideforum.me, where I'm going to continually give people updated information about information that they need to have an understanding of how to take advantage of technology, how to take advantage of the Internet, how to get people digitally literate, and how to achieve economic parity through technology and partner. Like I said, I'm in conversations with some great partners, hopefully being able to announce that soon, that will put us in various cities to really connect people to technology and connect college students, connect businesses, and really go in and make an impact so that people can see the power of technology can have in the community. And also, more importantly, can see the opportunities that are created when you give people a perspective and an opportunity in which they can do more. I really believe that that's what's missing in a lot of cases, is that when you make people aware that there's an opportunity in front of them and they understand the value of that opportunity, that they'll take advantage of it. I think specifically African Americans, you know, you talk about through history, not just technology, but we've proven that we're natural entrepreneurs. We've proven that we can go into a market and make ways out of no way. And I believe that in doing that and connecting that tenacity and that thought process to technology, that we'll really see great things happen. So that's going to be my focus throughout this year. It's part of that 10,000 campaign. It's just really getting in front of people and helping them understand and achieve what I believe we can achieve.
Yeah, that's a great way to end the show. I understand that there's going to be more panel discussions happening. You know, I think in New York, we're trying to work with Human Bookstore and the Malcolm X Center, and perhaps in New Jersey, maybe Newark or some other places. And so there will probably be other ways to network and collaborate on this very issue. As we leave, just one more plug for ways that people can get in touch with you. You have a website?
Sure. So people can reach me at NavarroWright.com. That's NavarroWright.com. Can read my blog, can find out where I'm speaking next, can invite me to speak through a link there, and as well find the NOAC Demos t-shirt store and apparel store, as well as following me on Twitter at Navarro Wright as well. You know, I encourage people to reach out to me, let me know about things that are going on in the area, and we're going to keep this dialogue going. And I definitely appreciate you guys having me on the show and giving me the opportunity to kind of share some of this information.
No, absolutely, and I want to thank you for staying a little extra. We went over time just a little bit, but I thought the content was juicy and it was well worth it. So thank you so much, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Sounds good. Be blessed, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Goodbye. Bye.